Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Billboard.com Pop Shop Podcast. My name is Keith Caulfield, and I am the co-director of charts at Billboard. Joining me, as always, is our own personal Academy Awards winner, Billboard's deputy editor, digital, Katie Atkinson.
I won? Should I give a speech?
I think you stole Frances McDormand's Oscar.
Oh, that wasn't me. Oh. But if you'd like to see the guy who did, check out his Facebook video.
The brazen gentleman who swiped Frances McDormand's Oscar, but luckily, Frances got it back. Well, as always, the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast is your one-stop shop for all things Oscar and pop on Billboard's weekly charts. In addition, you can always count on a lively discussion about the latest pop news, fun chart stats and stories, new music, and guest interviews with music stars and folks from the world of pop. Today on the show, we'll be chatting about our thoughts on the 90th Academy Awards, which were broadcast on Sunday, March 4th, and we'll discuss chart news about Post Malone, Kylie Minogue, and Bon Jovi.
Plus, we've got an interview with Max, the singer-songwriter behind the top 20 Billboard Hot 100 hit, Lights Down Low, with Nash. We talk about the song's slow and steady climb up the charts, the incredible one-shot video for the song, what his label boss Pete Wentz has to say about his success, and more. So stick around for that.
But first, before we get started, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe to the show on iTunes or any of your other traditional podcast providers, because I'm sure we're like, you know, if you don't use iTunes, you can certainly use something else.
Podcast Addict. That's what I use.
Yeah. my Alexa at home, I think, gets it from some other... yeah, I just blanked. Clearly not scripted. But whatever podcast distributor you use, subscribe to us. So you'll get us in your feed. And you can always review us and rate us and, you know, tweet about us and tell a friend, because, you know, why not share the good news?
Share it.
Yeah. And you can always see the rest of the podcast that Billboard has at itunes.com/billboardpodcast. Or we also have a podcast tab on billboard.com. Just
find us.
Fall into a rabbit hole with podcasts. Okay, let's run the Billboard chart numbers and do the chart chat. Here are three of the biggest headlines on the charts, at least in my opinion. First up, Post Malone's Psycho, featuring Ty Dolla $ign, makes a splash on the Billboard Hot 100 as the single debuts at number 2 on the tally, giving Post Malone his third top 10 and Ty Dolla $ign his second. Psycho, which was released on February 23rd, starts with 55 million streams earned in the week ending March 1st, 80,000 downloads sold, and 10.3 million in airplay audience earned in the week ending March 4th. The song bows at number 2 on the streaming songs chart, number 1 on digital song sales, but isn't on the 50 position radio songs chart yet, which is pretty much the case with how these things work. You know, certain hip hop songs will start off big in streams and then radio catches up, which is kind of what's happening with Drake's God's Plan. But more on that in a second. Psycho is just the 52nd song to debut in the top 2 on the Hot 100. And the 22nd to bow at number 2. The last song to start at number 2, Post Malone's own Rockstar featuring 21 Savage.
The people, they really like Post Malone.
People really like Post Malone. I wonder, not part of our notes, but, you know, I wonder if the love of Post Malone and the sort of the general baffledness at some people's enjoyment of Post Malone
yes,
is like it's a cyclical thing. Like, you know, back when, like, let's say Dre and Snoop came out in the early 90s, or like when Master P, or when Diddy, it's like whatever is like the super red hot hip hop thing at the moment, you know, there's always going to be maybe a segment of the population is just like, what the heck? I just don't get it. But I think Post Malone sonically is just so different from a lot of hip hop of the past. I think that's why it's taking a lot of people like, whoa, is this where hip hop is going? And I think that's why you have that general like,
yeah,
a lot of the time with Post Malone stuff. But anyway, I digress.
Yes.
Katie doesn't want to say anything. She's just looking at me.
I'm, like, just trying not to say anything.
Negative.
I just am not into it. That's it, obviously. Like, that's not a surprise with the way I'm talking about it.
Well, I think sonically, you know, what was it, like a year and a half, 2 years ago, when Migos started to happen, in a big way.
I feel like I understand the Migos appeal, and I understand the Ray Shremmerd appeal. Like, those are fun songs. They have, like, fun and funny lyrics.
Post Malone has a very sort of, like, hazy...
It's serious. It's, like, slow. It's, like, blah.
It's just, yeah.
It does not get a party started.
Yeah, but you don't think of Post Malone as, like, you know, let's hit the club.
Except for this weekend I was at a club and they played Congratulations, and I'm like, no, that does not make me want to dance. Okay, moving on.
Moving on. What are the chances of Psycho rising to number one on the Hot 100? Well, of the 21 songs that bowed at number two, 11 of them reached number one, including Rockstar. But a certain superstar named Drake is standing in Post Malone's way on the Hot 100, as Drake's own God's Plan stands tall at number one with a huge lead over Post Malone. God's Plan retains the top slot for a sixth week and notches big gains in airplay. As I mentioned earlier, Drake's God's Plan is one of those songs that starts off huge in streams and sales and then tapers off a little bit, and then radio catches up. That's what usually happens. And that's how this song can actually have a really long life at the top of the chart, when radio starts to embrace it and picks up for the streams that will eventually at some point, assumingly, we assume it'll go down. But who knows? We're in that weird time now where everything is just streaming.
What a time to be alive.
It's a Drake reference. Next up, 2018 marks the 30th anniversary of pop diva Kylie Minogue's debut on Billboard's charts.
Kylie.
And she's back on our list this week as her new single, Dancing, debuts at number 37 on the Dance Club Songs chart. Minogue's first chart entry came back on May 7th, 1988, with her first U.S. hit, I Should Be So Lucky, which debuted at number 86 that week, on its way to a number 26 peak a few months later. She would reach the top 10 for the first time later on in 1988 with her cover of The Locomotion. I think it was first a hit for Little Eva, I believe. On the Dance Club Songs chart, I Should Be So Lucky was her first hit as well, and over the course of her career, she's notched 23 hits on the list, including Dancing. Of those songs, 13 of them have actually hit number one, including songs like Can't Get You Out of My Head, All the Lovers, and Slow. Dancing is from Minogue's upcoming studio album titled Golden, which is out on April 6th. And finally, over on the Billboard 200 Albums chart, a familiar face, or faces, is back at number one as Bon Jovi's former chart topper, This House Is Not For Sale, is back atop the list, as the album re-enters at number one with 120,000 equivalent album units, nearly all of which was powered by sales generated from a, wait for it, concert ticket album sale redemption offer with their upcoming U.S. arena tour. The album actually first hit number one back in late 2016, also largely from sales generated from a ticket bundle. As for next week's Billboard 200 Albums chart, it's a little early for me to forecast this, but right now it's looking like the top debut will come from Tory Lane's new album, Memories Don't Die, which could start in the top three, and maybe number one. I literally don't have any like solid numbers yet. We're recording this early on Monday. Right now, our preliminary data, just sort of looking at the weekend returns, right now, Tory Lanez, Black Panther, the album, and The Greatest Showman are all kind of within range of one another. The latter title, The Greatest Showman, is benefiting from exposure on the Academy Awards this past weekend, where Keala Settle performed the movie's Oscar-nominated song, This Is Me. And I think the numbers that I'm looking at don't actually include Sunday numbers yet. So, you know, who knows what the impact just from Sunday night and the Oscar show is going to bring us on the album chart next week. So stay tuned.
Well, speaking of the Oscars.
Segue.
Let's talk about the 90th Academy Awards.
Hey, let's.
The Shape of Water was the big winner of the night, earning four wins, including Best Picture and Best Director. And as widely expected by Oscar forecasters, yeah, pretty much everything happened that was supposed to happen. Gary Oldman, yeah. Frances McDormand, Sam Rockwell, and Allison Janney won Best Actor, Actress, Supporting Actor, and Supporting Actress, respectively.
Yeah. If you were doing your Oscar pools and Oscar stuff, like you probably did pretty well in the acting category.
How did you do in your Oscar pool, by the way?
We did an Oscar pool here in the office with Billboard and The Hollywood Reporter, and I think I only got three wrong.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you don't know yet whether that's a winner?
Yeah, I doubt it. I doubt I won. I think the only ones I got wrong were visual effects, which I thought it was going to be War for the Planet of the Apes, and ended up being
Blade Runner,
I guess. And I got the short. Ooh, my stomach just growled. I'm so sorry if you heard that. I haven't had breakfast yet. I think it was the documentary short.
Okay, that was Dear Bat. No, that was the animated short. The documentary short was the one about the deaf child when they signed the speech.
And I picked the one about the elementary school.
Okay.
I think it was, yeah. And okay. Then the third one I missed was actually Best Picture. I picked Three Billboards instead of The Shape
Which
of Water.
Which is what won it, Golden Globes gave best, whatever their categories are, to Three Billboards.
So yeah, I think I got three wrong. How'd you do?
That's really good. I actually did not do a ballot.
Oh.
This year.
Did you do something within the household?
Nope.
Oh, okay. Well,
I watched. Well, and I kept telling my husband before people won who was going to win, and kept being right.
And kept ruining
and
it for
like,
him.
But then by the end, he was just like, "Well, this seems like really boring. If like you yeah. could say everything that's going to win."
Yeah, that's it. Does you know
it's
if
a
you,
danger
if you pay attention to if you pay attention to any of these. Sort of the Oscar forecasts or, you know, people, how they kind of predict the races, it can turn into a really boring show.
Right.
Because there's so many award shows that happen. The Oscars were aired later this year.
Yeah.
So it just turns into a coronation as opposed to a, you know, competition.
But then there's these ones, like, I feel like the Oscars are usually good for at least one out of left field acting winner.
And it
because
wasn't
like
this year, no.
I think it was last year. Was it last year that The Bridge of Spies supporting actor won?
A couple years ago, Mark Rylance.
Yeah, and I remember there was somebody else who was supposed to win it.
Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah,
I think.
That was it exactly from Creed. And so there's always, it feels like the Oscars are usually good for one of those left field wins. And last night it was all the people that were expected to win.
Yeah, I remember. I think it was the year where. Golly, and I don't even remember who actually won, but I remember there was a year where Burt Reynolds was nominated for Boogie Nights for Best Supporting Actor, and he lost.
I remember Eddie Murphy was supposed to win for Dreamgirls, and
right.
I don't remember who won, but that's, like, I just remember he was, like, poised and ready, like, halfway up in the seat, and somebody else won.
Oh, the year. See, it's funny. You remember who you think was supposed to win,
exactly.
but you don't remember who the winner was.
Exactly.
I remember the year that Lauren Bacall was nominated for The Mirror Has Two Faces. And it was,
The Mirror Has Two Faces.
People thought she was going to win because it's freaking Lauren Bacall, and she didn't.
Yeah.
And for the life of me, I can't remember.
Exactly. This is the thing. But we remember Lauren Bacall, so.
It's the thing with award shows in general. Sometimes you don't even remember who won Best Picture from the previous year.
Uh-huh.
Who won Best Picture last year?
Great question. Real solid question. That I don't have an answer to. You know?
Moonlight.
Oh, duh. La La Land. How am I not going to get that?
I don't know. You just didn't.
I just didn't.
So let's talk about some of our most notable moments from the show. I actually have notes. Katie does not. Do you want me to start?
Yeah, go for it.
So mine are in no particular order. Briefly talking about the performances in the show, the musical performances, they performed all five of the songs nominated for Best Original Song. I thought the kind of the most impactful one in terms of just sort of sheer like oomph was This Is Me from The Greatest Showman. Keala Settle did a great job. She was backed by, I don't know who the people were behind her. There was just a chorus that was dancing and singing along with her. I don't know if they were supposed to be important people.
Yeah.
Or like representations.
I was actually looking to see if Pasek and Paul might be back there in the chorus or something, but they weren't.
They weren't. but that I thought that was a great moment and a showstopper. And I feel like Sufjan Stevens, who was nominated for Mystery of Love from Call Me By Your Name, got the Sufa shaft. Because his performance was 1 minute and 40 seconds long.
It was very brief.
Very brief.
I wondered if that was the length of the song.
No.
Yeah.
It is not.
But I bet other people wondered that as well. I will say, and you might be about to say this, but I did like how they included, you know, quote-unquote background musicians who actually are all significant musicians in their own right.
Oh, yeah.
St. Vincent,
Chris
Thiel.
Is it Thiel or Thiele? Thiel?
I think it's Thiel.
He's the one who actually plays the banjo or mandolin that's actually on the track.
And you would know him from, he took over A Prairie Home Companion, which
Nickel
is
Creek.
Now called Live From Here. And yes, he's in Nickel Creek.
And there were some other people on the stage,
too. There was one other person that I knew well, who I'm just spacing on right now.
Well,
but.
the length of Mystery of Love is actually 4 minutes and 8 seconds long.
Wow.
And basically, he performed the first verse, and then there was like a sort of part of a bridge, and then he kind of modified the rest of it.
Great blazer.
Oh yeah, it was beautiful.
Beautiful coat.
But yeah, the rest of because I actually researched this because I was frustrated that Stand Up for Something is 3 minutes and 44 seconds long on record. It was 2 minutes and 40 seconds on stage.
Okay.
This Is Me is just under 4 minutes long on record. It was 3 minutes and 10 seconds on stage. Remember Me from Coco, a little complicated. They performed two versions of the song because there was four different versions that
one
exist.
One with Gael Garcia Bernal.
Which was lovely. And that was actually almost the entire recorded version because that's only 1 minute long on the soundtrack. And then the Miguel version is, you know, about like another 2 minutes and change. So combined, it was like maybe like 4 minutes combined, but on stage they got 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mighty River is actually a really long song. It's 5 minutes and 44 seconds long on the album, but it's 2 minutes and 45 seconds on stage. No matter how you cut it or slice it, Mystery of Love only had 1:40, and all the other four songs either had 1 minute or 1.5 more.
Okay, so here's a question. Knowing Sufjan Stevens, knowing, you know, he is an artist, do you think that they said, we need you to do an abridged version of the song, and he's like, the only way that will work is if we just do this verse and call it a day? You know what I mean? As opposed to, like, trying to truncate the entire song or chop off a half verse here and a half verse there. You know what I mean? Like, I could see that being the case and not them being like, you have 1 minute, you've got three, you've got, you know what I mean? I'm like, you know what I mean, times?
I think, as with all things, these things are probably difficult production decisions where, you know, they're like, look, we want to kind of give everyone the same amount of time.
Right.
And everyone got, you know, approaching 3 minutes except for Sufjan, which makes you think either A, there was probably an interesting discussion between Sufjan and his team and the producers of the show about, you know, how we're going to shorten the song. And maybe that's what they came up with. It just seemed way too short.
Right.
Or perhaps the Oscars put that limitation on Sufjan because maybe Mystery of Love didn't fit into their narrative of the evening.
It's quiet.
It's a quiet little ballad, and it doesn't fit into Stand Up for Something, where Common decided to do lyrics that had nothing to do with the song. Like, he just had whole new lyrics that were all about, like,
so the
NRA, Trump, and, like, you know, Time's Up. I'm like, that's not in the song.
The first verse that he did, you know, obviously was, like, freestyled, was not on the beat of the song, etc. But then when he did a second verse, and that's not the verse from the song, right?
No,
the one in
the song. I don't think
he did
the verse at all from the song.
Yeah, because all of a sudden I heard President. I'm like, President?
He has one verse in the song.
Yeah.
It's like, how would you call it? 2 bars? It's 8 bars? 16? 35? 64?
Probably 8 or 16.
It's like maybe like 15 seconds long on the song.
Wow.
And he comes in at the bridge.
Wow.
So, yeah. He had a whole lot more on stage last night.
Yeah,
and the same thing with Mighty River and This Is Me. They're all these big, like, empowerment, like, you know, and then Mystery of Love's like a little banjo and Sufjan. Like, yeah, I guess maybe it doesn't fall in your narrative. Anyway, that's one of my points.
Well, just to piggyback off of that and talk a little more about the song performances, it was surprising to me because I'm not super familiar with the song Remember Me from Coco because I haven't seen the movie yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it was surprising to me to see like Disney Miguel, because I'm so used to seeing like sexy like Prince Miguel that it was like, whoa, it is very odd to see Miguel doing like the Disney like show tune. He sounded great, but it was like a completely different human. I told Dan, like, that's Miguel, like, and he's like, that's Miguel, like, he had no idea.
It's funny, I don't have that same context because you've actually seen him live and like you're more of a fan, and to me I was just like, oh, it's Miguel.
Oh, it was bizarre.
So it's like, it's like seeing like D'Angelo or Prince like suddenly doing a Disney Pixar song. Oh, interesting.
Yes, absolutely.
So so was that one of your notable
moments?
Well,
I just wanted to point it out because I want to, like, and I agreed with you. I don't want to like repeat what you said, but like for me, This Is Me was the showstopper.
Yeah.
For sure. And I thought she sounded incredible. And I thought the way, like, she emoted through the song, I wasn't sure if she, like, legit was having a breakdown in the middle of
acting.
It was acting, because Kayala Settle is impressive.
She's a Tony Award-nominated actress,
yes,
for Pete's sakes.
So, go ahead for your next.
Well, I loved Frances McDormand's speech. You know, she does things her own way. She doesn't really do press. She doesn't do the whole awards circuit thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great to see her just kind of, like, let loose and really have a powerful moment where she, you know, invited all of the female nominees in the audience in all the categories to stand up. And then she said, everyone look at them and, you know, let's talk, let's make deals. You know, don't do it tonight at a party. Call us into your office, or you can come to our office, whatever's most convenient.
Don't do it while I have a glass of champagne in my hand.
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
And she said, you know, and let's talk about two words, inclusion writer, which of course everyone was like, what the hell is that?
Straight to Google.
And THR had a story about what an inclusion writer is.
A lot of explainers out there. Like, that was the... I Googled it.
I Googled it. It's basically the idea of that a star can put into their contract something, a writer, and that could be about anything. It could be, you know, I get this in my trailer, or I get whatever.
Fill my trailer with pink flowers and green M&Ms, or...
It's okay, Mariah. She doesn't do that. I mean, she might, but we don't know. But it
or
could,
you can request that the crew and the, or the background actors,
be
or...
a certain percentage of minorities, yeah. You know, females and minorities. Yep. So... It's a great idea. Will that happen? Who knows? But if you're a powerful enough woman, if you're Gal Gadot going into mm-hmm. Wonder Woman 2, maybe you can suggest that.
Yep.
You know, maybe you have that power now. If you are the cast of Black Panther, well, duh. But, you know, I mean, who knows?
I hope this doesn't step on one of yours, but I just wanted to shout out my two favorite presenters of the evening.
Okay.
It was two pairs of ladies. One we've already spoken about, Tiffany Haddish and Maya Rudolph.
Oh, they were great.
And I was telling Keith that Twitter, you know, right after Jimmy's monologue, which I thought was really great, by the way, Jimmy Kimmel, the host last night, I thought he was really great, but he talked a lot about Me Too and just the movement in Hollywood in general for women. And people were like, wouldn't that have been cooler had a female host been the one that said all this? Because Twitter loves to complain.
I'll eventually say the word. Twitter will never be satisfied with anything.
Right.
Because that is also representative of the population.
But then Tiffany Haddish and Maya Rudolph roll out, and everyone's like, this is specifically who we would like to host next year. And I have to say, it was pretty enjoyable a few moments on the show, and their back and forth just was, like, perfect. Like,
I wonder how rehearsed that was.
Oh, I'm sure it was plenty super rehearsed. Yeah, they were awesome together. And my other favorite presenting pair was Jodie Foster and Jennifer Lawrence.
Jodie Foster on crutches. Was that a real thing?
I think she was legitimately on crutches, but it was hilarious that they made it a bit, like with Meryl Streep.
Yeah, you know,
I thought for some reason they were a hilarious duo to look at together, too, because Jennifer Lawrence looked about seven feet tall.
Yeah, 7 feet
heels.
Four. I loved seeing the winners of Best Animated Feature, Coco, win. I don't know their names, but there were three of them. One of them was Lee one of the head Pixar persons,
yes,
who's won before. He was the last person to speak, but the first two people that spoke, the first woman who spoke thanked her wife, and the second person who spoke was a man, thanked his husband.
Yep.
Which I thought was just like, well, hell.
Yep.
And, you know, it's like two of the producers, I mean, I don't know, maybe Lee is also gay, I have no idea, but the first two were gay and thanking their, you know, spouses, and winning an Oscar for a film that is all about, you know, Mexico and the Mexican heritage, and it's just a cast of Mexican characters, which is just so beautiful to see this, like...
Really hitting it out of the diversity park here.
I thought that was pretty incredible.
Absolutely.
So that was another one of mine, and I can say another one if you
want
to.
Yeah, go for it.
I thought it was cool to see James Ivory win.
Yes.
Best Adapted Screenplay.
So obviously you knew that James Ivory wrote this because you're very familiar with this movie that I have yet to see. But I did not know that James Ivory wrote this movie. So when he got up there, I was like, well, like Ivory? Like Merchant Ivory?
As in, yes, the Ivory of Merchant Ivory.
Yeah. So that threw me off.
The merchant is no longer with us.
As he said in his speech.
So James Ivory, at 89 years old, is now the oldest Oscar winner ever. Or the oldest person to win an Oscar, at least a competitive Oscar, not an honorary Oscar. Mm-hmm. And if you noticed, on his under his suit jacket was a shirt with an interesting design on it. It was actually an illustration of the star of Call Me By Your Name, Timothy Chalamet.
Wow.
So Timothy made it to the stage last
yes.
night, even though he didn't win Best Actor. And so I've said all of mine except for one.
Okay, one other thing I wanted to say about just two of my favorite, comic actors who all of a sudden are in the Oscar world. Kumail Nanjiani, I love Silicon Valley. We've always loved him. I thought that the package that they did, that it started out with the introduction from the Harvey Weinstein victims, Ashley Judd, Annabella Ciora. Am I saying her name right?
Yes, I believe
and,
so.
And Salma Hayek. The package that they did that was all about diversity, Me Too, etc., Kumail, all of his moments in that, I thought he just absolutely killed it.
He was like, oh, you know, was it the scene images?
His wife has the idea of Muslims having fun as a website.
Eating ice cream.
Yeah. Which
riding a roller coaster.
It's brilliant. And then he also talked about, like, maybe now a straight white dude should have to relate to my story because I've been relating to their stories my entire life.
Which, you know, funny, I I'm with that. And, you know, speaking as a white man, who I'm already privileged in many ways, but also as a gay white man, I'm not privileged in many ways. I was on Tumblr last night before I went to bed, and there was an image set that I was on my feed. And I think it was... remind me who was in X-Men, who later came out as a lesbian.
Ellen Page.
Ellen Page. I think it was her, and I think it was from a documentary that she did. So, sorry, apologies, but I didn't do my research. But I just remember what she said. And she basically said, like, you know, we are born into a homophobic society. And that is just the way it is. And if you think about it, all of the stories that we hear, all of the movies that we see, all of the music that we hear,
comes from a straight perspective.
Comes from a straight perspective. And so you don't even realize it as you're growing up, but all you hear and all you see is basically a woman and a man, a woman and a man. And so when you do see something that is two men or two women, you're just, what the heck just happened? So it made me think about that in entertainment in a way where you sort of see that on a larger scale, mm-hmm. where it can be something like Black Panther, where suddenly black people are seeing such incredible representations of themselves.
Not just a movie with black actors in it, but a movie like superheroes and action and all these things that have historically left right. out the black audience.
And they do great at the box office. Yep. So the bottom line, money talks in Hollywood.
Yeah. You know, that was Kumail's other point.
Yeah. So, like, you know, clearly black folks, you know, can carry a film and a blockbuster film, and not only are black people going to see it, but white people are going to see it.
Of course.
And, you know,
just like black people have been going to see white movies this entire time.
Just like a bunch of gay people have been going to see straight things.
Quote unquote straight movies.
You know, how many damn romantic straight comedies with, you know, Reese Witherspoon have, you know, gays have to suffer through?
Yes. Oh, like, suffer. I love Reese.
Yes. Not that I don't love Reese, but that's why I flip out over Call Me By Your Name.
Exactly.
You know, you get these movies like every so often that are like high quality Hollywood movies that are like in awards like discussion,
which is a good note to say. Jordan Peele also broke my heart when he was up on stage last night from Key and Peele from Comedy Central
right
from Mad TV to the Oscars stage.
He was on Mad TV.
Oh yeah, him wow. and Key actually were on Mad TV, but like he was just magnificent, and that movie is spectacular, and they should make more movies like that. And go on to your last item.
My last item, the stunt that Jimmy Kimmel pulled where he said that next door at the movie theater, the Grauman's
yes.
Theater, they were showing an advanced screening of A Wrinkle in Time to unsuspecting moviegoers, and they wanted to have actors and the audience stars go and thank them for going to the movies.
Yes.
Because really, at the end of the day, the thing that keeps all these movies going is the fact that you go and buy tickets.
Yes.
And so I've seen so many gift sets and memes of Armie Hammer dancing and Call Me By Your Name, and if everyone that made one of those memes or reblogged it or retweeted it had paid a couple bucks to see the movie or rent the movie, well, then that movie would have made a whole heck of a lot more money and whatever.
Right.
But anyway, so they did a stunt during the show where Jimmy took a bunch of stars next door, including Armie Hammer from Call Me By Your Name, and Ansel Elgort and Gal Gadot and Mark Hamill and some bunch of other people, and surprised the audience, and all of them came in with snacks to give out. And of course they armed the two probably most dashing men, Ansel Elgort and Armie Hammer, with hot dog cannons. Because of course wouldn't you? Also, by the way, Armie Hammer was sick on Saturday.
Yeah, when he bounced up to go over to that theater, I had heard that he was sick.
He had an IV drip yep. in him on Saturday night. He had the flu. He couldn't go to the Indie Spirit Awards.
Oh, I'm like, but he put on that burgundy velvet and he got out there.
Never mind that Armie Hammer is now like launching hot dogs and he has the flu.
Exactly.
Sure. Let's not think about that for too long. He didn't actually handle the food, people. But a friend of mine who's a writer as well, Matthew Rettenman, he tweeted yesterday, directing people to his website. Full list of Oscar winners, you know, linking to his site. But the real winner was anyone who caught one of Armie Hammer's wieners.
Ah!
Ayo!
Incredible.
So those were my sort of notable moments from the Oscars. That segment ran on way too long.
But clearly we started this out by saying it was so boring because the awards were all predictable. And then we just raved about a million moments. So yeah, clearly we had fun.
Yeah.
Should we move on to our interview?
Yes.
So we had an interview with our friend Max. We actually had Max on the podcast last year when he was just making a name for himself. And now he's back to talk about his first bona fide hit song, Lights Down Low, featuring Nash. The song's been climbing and climbing up the charts, reaching the top 10 of the pop songs chart in its 27th week. It now sits at number 7 on the chart.
Keeps on moving.
And it also marks his first visit to the top 20 of the Hot 100. We talked all about why this song specifically connected with such a big audience and why the song's personal connection makes its success that much more special, how he came up with the idea for the song's emotional video, what his label boss Pete Wentz has to say about the hit, and much more. So check out our interview with Max. Hello to Max, and welcome back to the Billboard Pop Shop podcast.
Thank you for having me back. I'm delighted to be here.
Of course, and actually, it's like really exciting to have you right now because Lights Down Low is officially your first top 10 on our Pop Songs Airplay chart and
yes,
top 40 on Billboard Hot 100.
I'm honored. It's mind-blowing.
Congratulations.
Really thank you.
How does it feel?
It feels, it's surreal. I'm so happy that it's this song, it's this story, it's what means so much to me and to my whole squad. You know, it's I can't imagine it being something else. It's been the learning lesson of only doing things that you really believe in and are passionate about, because if it were something that I didn't feel this way about, it would be very empty, and I'm sure it would be. So it's definitely a life lesson to, even if it takes forever, just fight for the things that you really care about and believe in. Even if the song's taken almost, you know, over two years to get to this point.
Yeah, actually, the song had the slow and steady wins the race trajectory. It reached the top 10 of the Pop Songs chart in its 27th week.
Yeah, crazy.
Which is the second longest climb ever to the top 10 in the 25-year history of the chart.
Wow.
Did you feel that, like, as the song was continuing to grow over the past 6 months, that people and certainly radio stations were connecting with it in a special way?
It's meant so much more in such a special way, because I think that it's given such a gravity to the song to be able to know that there's, you know, the people that have heard it from the very beginning, or maybe people are just starting to hear it, what it means to different people depending on when they've started to hear it in these places, or even the places like the radio stations that have been playing it for so long or just started, whatever. It's like the depth that it's been that it's gotten to because it's taken so long has been so beautiful to see people feel a part of it.
Yeah.
And that's something I think you can't really, I could never replicate with something that happened right away, because when people feel a part of something with you, it's so special. And that was,
yeah,
that's been so wonderful to have, you know, people be like, I've been there since the beginning, or people be like, I just jumped on and I'm excited about it.
Yeah. And it's like word of mouth, which,
yeah,
means people love it and are talking about it, right?
Totally.
Do you happen to know what song had the longer climb? Did you
this yeah
already?
Someone told me it, but I it was in the 90s,
yeah,
right? I forget who it was.
It's I'll Be by Edwin McCain,
right? Edwin
which
McCain
is
yeah
huge song,
yeah, totally,
and had the same kind of like slow build, you know.
Crazy.
It makes sense. Also a very like emotional song.
Crazy.
Can we talk a little bit about Lights Down Low? You know, you've called it a turning point in terms of your songwriting. What do you mean by that?
I think that I always say it because before that I was, you know, I think I was writing from a place of like, oh, what can everybody relate to, you know? And I think it's really poisonous to try to write something big or do something big. Like, I think you just, with this one, I inadvertently learned this lesson because I kind of gave up and I just wanted to write something for my now wife. I just wanted to write a song for her and not think about who's going to hear it outside of that. And, you know, ironically and luckily, that's the one that people are hearing, because
yeah,
it's been truthful and raw to what I feel about another person. And I think that's what I need to every artist, I would hope, always write from that place. It's, your life is different than everybody else's, but at the same time, the things that you do relate and share with that are real are going to be the things that other people really feel, and that's a lesson I've always wished I learned, and now finally having learned it, I'm so grateful to continue to take it everywhere.
Yeah. It's crazy to think that the most personal thing is the most universal thing too.
It's fascinating. You don't think that those things are the things that, like, something so simple is going to be something that everybody has been through or gone through. You know it, but you just think, why would anybody want to hear that? Or why would anybody want to, like, it needs to have a thing and whatever else. And I think it's so important to, like, don't think of the thing. Just be truthful to the thing.
And that leads perfectly into the video, which is, like, super. I watched it, and I'm like, oh, I'm liking this. It's such a cool concept. Mm-hmm. And then as it goes on and you age and you're, you know, still playing, like, as an elderly couple, and that, I mean, it, like, really struck me way harder than I expected it to.
I'm so glad.
And I'm sure that, you know, 25 million people seem to agree with me, the number of views that are on YouTube right now. You know, how did this concept come around? Yeah. And just tell me about this whole video, because it's so emotional.
So my two of my favorite collaborators who I've done a bunch of videos with, my friend Jade Ellers and Brendan Walter, are two directors I've done tons of videos with. And we sat down and we realized, you know, this concept kind of came to be. Jade said, like, I want to do, like, another one-shot thing. I've done lots of one-shot things in the past, you know, and there's such a storytelling element that you don't find as much unless you, like, literally are in one place. That one shot, there's not as, like, you really have to focus on the story and what is. You can't do camera work that flips it around. So we started there, and Jade said, like, what if there's just, like, one, like, above a bed, like, a room? And then we all started diving into the elements that really make that. Like, my wife helped choose all of the furniture you see throughout the whole thing.
And, like the pillows change.
The pillows change, and the bed changes. And, like, you know, we just got a new bed, and I had the same one for, like, 20 years. And so it's amazing that all those little things were everybody contributing to it. And that's what we really wanted to make sure was clear, that it's about the details, less so than, like, the simplicity is the space. The space is simple, just like the song. And what are the things in between that make it what real, and what it's supposed to feel like when you really do live in a room forever? Because we really do. Like, we live in our, aside from moving around, we live in one space for most of our lives. We sleep in a bed for a third of our lives. It's like, what are the things around you that you choose to have your space with, and what do those mean to a relationship? And so it was really important that we started in sort of an easy, loving way, and then suddenly, as we age, finding the things that happen in life. And that's the beauty. A lot of people, when we started pitching the idea around, were like, it's so sad. Like,
but it's also life.
That's life. And that's the point of the song, is that, you know, this song, especially being that I've been, you know, talking about this song, and it's so about my wife, of course, and I tell that story everywhere, that it's meant more and more. We as a couple are, you know, we communicate really well, but we have plenty of fights and different things. And I think that that's what we wanted to make sure. It's not like people shouldn't be, if you're longing for a relationship, know that the best one is not something that doesn't have any of those difficulties. It's something that you work through with that person. And that's the same in this, you know, her getting sick and all of these different moments. That was what was important to us. And that's, again, that's the beauty of it, of us passing away, because we're all going to pass away. And it's, what are the little moments you remember that really matter? Not necessarily just the proposal. It's like, it's the little tiny things of, like, being old people and not knowing how to take selfies and things like that, that we really wanted to get across in it. And then having the couple at the end was really important too, to just show that, like, we're going to all be gone, and someone else will utilize the energy we've left on the earth. And maybe they don't even knew we were there. They don't even know a life that we live. We don't know lives that were lived here millions of years ago. But they'll feel that space and what you leave this earth with, what that space is left with. And that was really important for us to leave.
That's awesome. Oh, obviously, nice. You feel a lot behind the video and the song. We actually recently spoke to Pete.
Oh, awesome.
About your success with this song. Oh, cool. And I have a little quote from him.
Aww.
He said, this one is especially cool just because Max has really grinded it out. He really went out and did the work. I think lots of times you tell people you do the work and you'll see a payoff, but to actually see it months later is really cool. I'm super proud of him. You know, how does it feel to hear that from Pete?
That's awesome, because, you know, I think one of the biggest things that I've always respected the most about Pete and the whole band, all the Fall Out Boy, is that they've gotten to the point they're at because they do the work. They do grind it out. And in the end, the piece, whatever you're trying to have people hear or see, it's got to have everything you've got in it. But everybody has pieces that they want people to hear or see. And you have to give that extra mile. Like it's a part of it. And it's beautiful to see that they are definitely at the place they are because they went that extra mile. And they took those extra shows and they did that extra time in the studio where they did those extra interviews, and it humbles you. I think it makes you realize that. My wife says it to me all the time. She's like, so are you ever going to be able to like not do all of this stuff as much? I'm like, I think it'll only get worse. I'm going to have to do more of that stuff. Yeah. And that's, you got to love that. And they've consistently shown that they love the process, and that's why you still know Fall Out Boy and all their music is great.
Still getting number one albums.
That's why they're killing the game, exactly. Taking the risks. It's awesome.
So your album, Hell's Kitchen Angel, came out a year ago in April, and now you're already working on a new project. Yeah. So where are we with it so far?
We're getting there. I think it's beautiful that this has had the success that it's had, but it's of course there's new pressure in certain ways to, and the thing for me is to not. The hardest thing is not to give in to that pressure. And I think it's something
you just
that
need to pump out, more right? Super personal, yeah. super impactful songs.
Of
that's
course.
All.
and it's so interesting because then people are like, okay, well now you need this. You need you need an up tempo banger, and like it's got to be, personal, and those kinds of things start to come together. And when you're trying to do the thing rarely happens. And I think that's been my biggest excitement because we've learned to fight for what we believe with this song, and the vision that goes behind it, unfortunately in the music world and just in the listener world, like people like only know this song of mine. They're like, do you have other songs? And I forget. It's like, oh yeah, I have this song.
You have the fans that know it all.
Yeah, you have the OGs who know, who were like, when's the new music coming out? And then I go to some radio stations and people are like, oh, so are you going to put out more songs? And I'm just like, don't get upset. Don't get angry. Just know that's the world. Like, you know this one because it's been heard in this way. That's why we promote it so much. We do so much for it. But because of that, I realize as well, whatever the next thing that besides the whole body of work, having the vision be there, which I do have, the rest of it is so important to know that what's the next thing that I'm going to spend this amount of time giving love to. And it's got to really matter.
Yeah.
It's got to mean just as much, if not more so. And it's got to be something that I'm willing to fight for, and not something I would ever fake fighting for. And I can't imagine, I would hate my life if I were promoting something that I really wasn't into. And I feel like you can always tell, So, anyway, that's a long answer of me. This is a very therapeutic podcast moment for me. But I'm getting there. But I think it's just a matter of really diving into what you believe in, and that's what I'm trying to do right now with this record.
And you're touring with AJR.
They
had a co-write on your
they
last
did
album,
yeah
right?
Hey baby,
are you working with them again?
I want to music? I would love to. They're so great. The song I did with them was a song called Home, and it was actually right after I had written Lights Down Low. I found this new phase of writing where I was like, what am I doing, just like write from a personal place. And I had a pregnancy scare with my wife, and it was basically us just like, real, are we ready to be parents? It was, I wrote this song the next day. I had a session with the AJR boys, and we got in, and I was like, all right, well, this just happened. Like, I thought she's not pregnant, but like, I couldn't sleep all night. So we just wrote that song, and it was so cool because songwriting, I try to explain it to Emily sometimes. She's always like, so you just like told people you just met like about us having like a pregnancy scare? Like, you just met these people. And it's amazing how when you write songs with people or you create with people in certain ways, that's just a part of it. If you're not so transparent and honest, it's not going to be shown in the work.
Yeah.
And I personally love that. I love meeting someone for the first time and be like, all right, anyway, so like, we thought we were pregnant. We're not. It's cool. Let's write about that. I just met you 5 seconds ago. And so that's something I love with them. And they're just amazing writers and producers. They're just, they have fought for their sound and what they believe in. And they've, one of the only groups that I can truly say I've been in the trenches with for years now, and to see them be so successful and be so celebrated is beautiful. I'm so happy for them, and so hopefully we'll definitely write something
awesome
for the next record.
They're good dudes. They've been in before.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Well,
nice Jewish boys. I love them. I'm my people. Try.
All right, I've already kept you a little long, so I really appreciate your time today. Thank
awesome.
You.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For coming into Billboard and good luck with all the new music.
Thank you for the beautiful therapeutic podcast.
Of course,
Boys the Bomb.
Yes. Our
appreciate
session is
you.
Over.
Delicious.
And darling, where do we go? Do we make this up?
thanks so much to Max for stopping by the office. Happy that he's still a friend of the Pop Shop, even though he's so big time now. We look forward to seeing how far that song can just keep on climbing.
Yeah. And now it's time for the chart stat of the week. 15 years ago this week, 50 Cent topped the Billboard Hot 100 with In Da Club. The song, with its memorable "Go Shorty, It's Your Birthday," reached number one on the list dated March 8th, 2003, and spent a total of 9 weeks atop the list. It was the first of 4 number ones for the rapper, who also led the list with 21 Questions, Candy Shop, and Crack a Bottle. The latter is a collaboration with Eminem and Dr. Dre. 50 Cent was also a force on the Billboard 200 albums chart, of course, logging six top 10 number one albums. If only that was a thing. 6 top 10 albums, including a pair of number ones with Get Rich or Die Tryin' and The Massacre. So there you have it. 15 years ago this week. It's been 15 years since In Da Club. 50 Cent got his first number one on the Hot 100 with In Da Club.
Go, 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 go.
15 years. It's crazy. It's crazy. I was like looking at, you know, because Madonna, obviously, Ray of Light, her album Ray of Light, was released on March 3rd, 1998. So 20 years ago. I'm like, wow, I'm that old, huh?
I remember when 50 Cent was like a new rapper very vividly.
Yeah.
And like that was 15 years ago, apparently.
Yeah. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
What song should we go out on?
We've talked a lot about a lot of songs. I don't know. What do you think? Ooh, can we do a Kylie Minogue song?
Ooh, sure. Yeah.
You pick.
Oh, golly. It can't get you out of my head.
Done.
All right. See you guys next time.
Bye.